Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, July 21st, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Scott Tipps, president of the National Health Federation, to talk about global and domestic food standards and what it means to both the financial system and to you and me. Sneak preview. I wanted to just tell you, you may have noticed we have a new blog up. It looks pretty much like the old one, but there's some slight differences. And we're beta testing the public version. The reason we've put up a new blog is so that when you log in as a subscriber, it will open up into a private blog. We'll be prototyping it over the next 2 weeks. We hope to have it launched sometime between Labor Day and mid-September. And what it will do is it will allow us to put up the Soleri Report in audio chapters and with outlines of what the text was. It will make it much more searchable. And it will also, we will allow subscribers to have moderated comments so there can be discussion. I've spent a fair amount of time since I've been in California meeting and getting to know some of the subscribers, and you're an unbelievably intelligent and attractive group of people, so perhaps you might enjoy sort of communicating as a community. Anyway, so we hope to have that ready for you in September, and a lot of work has gone into doing it over the last year, and I think it's going to make the Soleri Report content much more accessible and easy to access, including selectively. So I'm looking forward to that coming about. Our theme tonight is Slow Burn on the Prairie Two-Step. Our theme for the year for 2011 was Slow Burn on the Prairie. And what we're watching, and it's the big story in money and markets, of course, is the two-step that everybody's doing, or maybe I should say tap dance over the debt limit discussions. They continue. We clearly don't have a deal yet. What you're watching is the negotiation of a framework that will keep the slow burn going through the 2012 election. Treasury used the ultimate threat last week that ESF operations would be discontinued if to save money. I don't believe it to watch the market, but that is the ultimate threat. And as we talked about last week, Rubin's dipping into the ESF in 1995 is what made the last debt limit, or one of the last debt limit conversations, so sort of furious and with having profound ramifications for policy. The stock market has been seesawing back in a channel for quite some time. Everybody's sitting around trying to guess which way the trend will go, and it keeps seesawing back in the channel up again the last couple days, but expect that to continue for a while. The Democrats reacted angrily to reports that the White House is going to cut a deal with the White House Republicans. House Republicans to boost the debt limit, and Obama's team has been negotiating, and the Speaker, the House Speaker, is sort of indicating that one is at hand. My favorite quote on the subject, because you can see the Democrats seething, was Senator Barbara Mikulski, who I used to work with when I was in Washington. She said, quote, "We are very volcanic at this moment," and I can just see her. She's very short and very explosive. She's one of the better nuts and bolts populace in the Senate, and in fact, she was the person who taught me to listen to books on tape. She always drives in from Baltimore with staffers, and they would listen to books on tapes coming in and going back, so they'd kind of read the classics and to decompress from what they were doing in the Senate. The thing that you see in these negotiations is an incredible disassociation in the popular thinking on understanding how government and federal government money relates to their life. We see polls with 28% to 38% over the last 2 weeks thinking it's okay to raise the debt limit. That's really a very small part of the population when you consider the part of the population which is very financially dependent on money coming out of the U.S. government debt. One UBS report for investors going around the internet right now on the investment ramifications of the current negotiations says, quotes a poll in Ohio showing 70% of respondents don't think it was a big deal if the debt ceiling isn't raised. Now, this, as I've said many times before, this shows a complete lack of understanding of how much every household and every local economy, every state and municipal government is entirely dependent on money coming from the federal government, which is entirely dependent on borrowing and printing money. And it's this kind of disassociation that makes crafting any kind of solution that much harder. What you're watching, though, is sort of all the pigs at the trough get gridlocked as they try and go through the toll booth. So how you negotiate a new framework is everybody cuts the deals on what they get if they go along with a new one. And so I think part of what you're watching is all these different groups agreeing as to what they get if indeed you stick it to Main Street. But I, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see people like Mikulski and Kucinich holding out. The situation is very fluid, but let me give you some of my current handicap just as of today. 75% chance they have a deal by next Tuesday via the Bohemian Grove, as I've said before. 90% chance they raise the debt limit on time. 90% chance Treasury has more slick tricks up their sleeve. They say they can't take it past August 2nd. I'm sure they can. At this point, it'd be irresponsible to not have more tricks up your sleeve. They usually do. 8% chance they raise the debt limit after the deadline. So I think they'll make the deadline. But if they don't, I think Treasury has more tricks up their sleeve, and then they can go ahead and do it. I think the chance of a default is very small, but let's give it maybe 2%. The result's going to be an engineered framework for a slow burning from now until the election. And again, it's going to protect the top and squeeze everyone else. I want to go through again what it means to the average household, because it's very important to see what this is going to come down to in terms of dollars and cents on your financial situation. In the short run, I think there's a good chance we get the dollar rallying. The dollar was down again, hitting, it's sort of running around the 74 point of the U.S. dollar index. But I think we could get a dollar rally and as much, if it stays strong, it up into the 80, or at least hit 80. Precious metals don't, I think we're going to be very strong in the third and fourth quarter, but we could get a dip. Unless there's a clear signal for more QE support, QE3 right away. If you look at the heat waves, the flooding and tornadoes, I think it means there's plenty of covert QE3 going on, so the Fed can and the banks continue to offload mortgages into the federal balance sheet or into the federal funds like the FHA fund. We may not get a QE3 right away, but we'll certainly get the deal that will provide it. Now, the wild card, as I said last week, is if they take off the debt ceiling, then we're in QE perpetual. Either way, inflation kicks up. Whether it's the debt ceiling issue, there's going to be more efforts to push to negate the Constitution by 2013, because to keep the slow burn going. So beware all the activists promoting a constitutional convention, because the last thing you want is these guys to be able to open up the Constitution. But if you look at the money, that's what they probably think they're going to need to do. Okay, so bring it down to a household. We're watching negative interest rates really squeeze people's balance sheets if they haven't repositioned. So no yields on bank deposits, fixed income, your annuities and life insurance, many of them are being debased. The debasement is really working the balance sheet pretty hard on the asset side. And that is, don't be surprised to see more incentives given to financial institutions and then financial institutions giving people more incentive to try and talk them back into the dollar and long-term bets on the dollar, like life insurance. Expenses are rising, according to shadow stats, at 6.5% to 11% now. It's very hard to see a resolution that doesn't take that up to the higher part of that channel, so 8% to 11%. Taxes are probably rising, depending on where you live. A lot of the greatest pain here is not so much evident in the money, but it's the debasement of our time, it's the debasement of our environment, it's the debasement of products and services. So let's say the price you pay for tuna fish may go up 25 cents a can, but the amount of tuna fish in it is shrinking and the amount of water in it is rising, and the quality control standards are diminishing, and all of that contributes to a real debasement, but you may not just see it in the prices. And of course, incomes are falling. We see more announcements. Borders Bookstore going into liquidation. Cisco saying they're laying off 10,000 people. So incomes are certainly not anywhere near keeping up with inflation. And of course, a big part of this deal is going to be continuing to squeeze down on Medicare, Medicaid, and to squeeze down on the Social Security COLA. So if you're basically dependent on Social Security and a fixed income, and inflation's going up at 6.5 to 11, and your COLA's 2% and falling, it doesn't take anything but high school math to understand where that's going. So purchasing power is diminishing tremendously. I was on Coast to Coast for an hour Monday evening, and was asked again about the confiscation of gold, and tried to focus the conversation on the fact that we are having our money confiscated now. It's our purchasing power confiscated through the dollar, and that's why it's so important that you understand this and take actions to reposition to protect it. So I said, you know, I don't think there's much chance of a confiscation of gold, but I do think there's 100% chance that the confiscation, that your purchasing power is being confiscated through the dollar as we speak, and it's going to, one way or another, there's 100% it's going to accelerate after this debt deal. Again, as I mentioned, the Borders Bookstore going into liquidation is an important sort of story to look at, because we're watching a complete revolution from the desktop to handheld devices, and we're going to a world where media and entertainment is delivered not through so much the TV or a desktop, but through handheld devices and phones. So this is going to have sort of creative destruction across the board. And, of course, it's a condition precedent for a digital currency, because once you get everybody with a handheld device, then you're into a whole new way of delivering everything, including money and financial services. So that's money and markets for this week. Our hero of the week is Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory was a very famous comedian. I heard him speak originally in 1970. He came to my college, and he started off by reading the Declaration of Independence, and it's one of the most fascinating performances I've ever seen. And Dick Gregory has become, you know, just quite an amazing activist and very interested in health and natural health. And as he's aged, he's in his 70s, might even be in his 80s now, he's become more and more forthright. He was always a very bold and honest person, but now he's really come into a whole new phase. And I hadn't watched any of his stuff, and a friend of mine sent me several of his videos, and I started to watch it. And we're really not, most people are not used to, particularly if they're not African American, listening to somebody who's quite that honest, coming from the African American side of it, let alone who has such good sources of intelligence from the covert side, because he's been, as an activist, he's been deeply exploring the covert side for decades and decades. And, you know, but there's a lot of quite good information and materials, and he's very funny. So if you don't mind it raw, it will make you laugh. It reminds me, you know, it's important to understand that a lot of the things that are happening broadly to the middle class in America now are very much techniques that were, if you will, prototyped on the black community. The black community called the when the sort of Mr. Global came in and brought drugs and all sorts of stuff into a neighborhood, they called it a beatdown, you know. And so you'd have sort of media criticism and drugs flow in and all sorts of economic warfare and dirty tricks. So they called it a beatdown, and to a certain extent now we're having a, you know, beatdown from C to C. But you can learn a lot from, especially from the great African-American churches. One of my favorite preachers is T.D. Jakes in Dallas. And if you listen to T.D. Jakes preach on spiritual warfare, there's an enormous amount of information and tools about how to sort of best the tapeworm. I put up a couple weeks ago an interview, or a link to an interview by Stuart Swerdlow, who was claims to have worked in covert activities out of Montauk, and is clearly very intelligent and knowledgeable. And one of the things he claims is that the ethnic cleansing targeted at the African American community was done because they, as a group of people, are much harder to control than white people. They're much less obedient. And believe it or not, that very much fits with sort of my understanding and knowledge and history. It was very interesting. After 9/11, when 9/11 happened the next morning, I was walking across the town commons in Hickory Valley, and one of the local farmhands came up, an African-American. He said, "We think the Bushes did it. What do you think?" Well, of course, the whole white population was, the whole Caucasian population just, you know, was on board and thinking we'd been attacked by a bunch of Muslims. And the discrepancy between the two cultures in terms of their take on things was quite remarkable. Anyway, so if you're interested, take a look at Dick Gregory. It's quite humorous and quite funny, but quite strong and very uncut and raw. Okay, great. Some great questions. And ask Catherine, can we do a report on the China bubble? Yes, as I've said before, I expect to be in Asia next year, and we'll probably do it there. Great question. Do you think the attempt to achieve one world government currency by the Western banks will succeed? We talked about this a little bit with Franklin last week, but I just wanted to mention it's important to understand that I think the march to world currency, there's dynamic to have a one world currency, and in fact, really a two-tiered system where you have a way of settling accounts between the central banks for trade, a one world currency, and then there's a natural need for much more local and lots of them. So it's a multivariate world, but to have a one world reserve currency, there I think there's some natural demand for it. And the question is not so much will we have it, but who will control it, who will govern it, will it be subject to transparency, will it be combined with digital technology really in a very invasive way as a mechanism of control. And I think the debate is not so much about whether or not we'll have a one world currency, but who's going to control it, who will govern it, and whether or not efforts to create alternative currencies will be stopped or controlled. So, you know, it goes back to will we optimize for the good of all, or will we optimize for a few in a way that's not for the good of all at all? And that's really what the debate is about. Another question, all the information from various newsletters are stating we're heading into a depression-like era around 2004 on the outside. What do you think? I think we're already, you know, it depends on which part of the population you are, but if you're in Greece, you're already in a depression. You were in a depression in Russia starting in the 90s. If you live in Hardeman County, Tennessee, you're struggling with something that's fairly depression-like. So I continue to think we're going to be in a slow burn with different pockets hit, as I said. And I think before we go into a serious kind of depression, rather than get a depression, you're going to get wars, plagues, and disaster capitalism, more what we're seeing, weather warfare. Of course, the wild card is we can bring in new technology. We don't have to have a depression. So as I said many times, our problems are not economic. They're political. A great question. Would love to learn more about entrainment technologies on TV, live speeches, and over the phone. What are they doing? How are they doing it? How can we protect and defend against it? Boy, what I would love to do a series of Solari reports on this, but finding reliable people to talk about it is really challenging. There are some good people, as the questioner pointed out, on propaganda, and I can try and find those. We did on Let's Go to the Movies, Adam Curtis's documentaries, and I really recommend that you take a look at some of those because they're quite good. One of them is Century of Self. They're available on the internet, and they really go to the heart of this question. They're very good. There are a couple good books on sort of mind control, both individual specific and sort of in general, and we did a Solari report on mind control, and I encourage you to go back and look at that. The other thing I wanted to let you know in this vein is I'm reading a book called The Parent's Guide to Texting, Facebook, and Social Media, Understanding the Benefits and Dangers of Parenting in a Digital World, and I'm going to probably have this author or another one like her on, because I think the scariest part of the of these technologies is how do we help young people who are very, very susceptible sort of manage them because they're so powerful and they can be so invasive. So more on that later. Another question about the scandal. There's an ATF scandal with allegations that that Americans were running the guns into the Mexican drug cartels. As you probably noticed, about two weeks ago, President Obama announced a deal to allow Mexican truckers to truck into the United States. That's a big shift. Pretty shocking. The politics of not living up to that part of the NAFTA agreement have been pretty strong, and we've kept the Mexican truckers out for a long time. I suspect that the reason that deal popped out was to sort of mollify Mexico and cover up the allegations coming out on the ATF scandal, which looked pretty ugly, but wouldn't surprise me in the least if they're true. Another question, what are your thoughts on permanent portfolio? Permanent portfolio is a mutual fund and one known to have a balance that includes precious metals. I'm under very strict advice from my attorney not to provide investment advice, so I'm not going to comment one way or another on permanent portfolio. But the one thing I can say is that at C-Lane Advisory, we publish our top 10 holdings in the Tradewinds model portfolio. Right now, it's the target allocation. And so if you go to the C-Lane Advisory website at claneadvisory.com and you want to look at the top 10 holdings at any time, we'll change them quarterly. So you can certainly see what we're doing in C-Lane because we try and make that transparent. That's it for Ask Catherine, and now it's my pleasure to introduce to you Scott Tipps, who is someone I've had the pleasure of talking with off and on for a while now. He's the president of the National Health Federation. He's an attorney and an expert on Codex. And the Codex is sort of international standards, codes, and practices, guidelines, relating to food and food production, and it's one of those things I've known for years that I really needed to understand, and we'll all occasionally get emails saying, oh no, they're doing this at Codex, and so finally I said, I've got to understand this, and I've got to get the sort of top person we can trust on this to explain it all to us. And so I'm thrilled that Scott is finally able to join us on the Solaria Report. And I should note, he's speaking to us from Paris, where it's it's much later. So it's a real treat that we have him. But we really appreciate him coming in at an unusual time and all the way from Paris. So Scott, are you with us?
I am. Thank you, Catherine, for that nice introduction.
Well, tell us. Let's start with how in the world. You know, because you just don't come home from school at the age of six and tell your mother, I think I'm going to become an expert in global food standards.
No, you're right. I had to wait 8 years for that, and the two but nearly that. Well, at least I got involved in politics when I was 14, and then it all went downhill from there. But basically, I always had an interest in health and nutrition. And then later in life, when I became an attorney, I had two close friends, Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw of the Life Extension fame, who said, Scott, you're an attorney and you're interested in health and nutrition. Why don't you do food and drug law? And that's kind of how I eased into it, was that way.
And so when did you go to the National Health Federation?
That was around 1986, and I was introduced to it by a gentleman named Andrew McNaughton, whose father used to be head of the Royal Canadian Air Force, and he himself had been a test pilot. But he had immigrated to the U.S. and was quite involved in the Laetril process, selling and getting it legalized. And, in fact, the National Health Federation was directly responsible for getting the sale of Laetril, which, as you may know or recall, is a touted cancer cure, and not for everyone, but for many, and was being sold as such, and the NHF got it legalized in 27 different states. And he brought me in at that time. I became a member, but I didn't actually join the board or become its chief legal counsel until 3 years later in 1989, when there was an opening in the board, and I could do that. And we had a president at the time, Maureen Kennedy Solomon. We became good friends and went through some good times, some bad times, and the like. But, you know, it's the world's oldest health freedom organization, and for many, many decades, we were the only game in town. And at this point, I think we're at 56 years and still growing and still continuing. So the interesting thing is that we had become alerted to the Codex Alimentarius process, and we had sent some reporter to report on it for several years in the 90s. But with me being over here in Europe, it became very easy for me to start attending Codex meetings, and I suggested to Maureen Solomon that I do that, and she very quickly said, yes, go ahead, do it. So for about the grand sum of $600, I attended my first Codex meeting in Berlin in the year 2000. And at this point, probably of all health freedom activists, I've probably attended more Codex meetings than any other such activist, now about 11 years, almost 12 years down the road.
So what in the world is Codex?
Well, Codex is an ongoing process that was created by two organizations, the Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization, back through a series of resolutions in the time period 1961-63. And it kind of
trudged
along.
Now, Food and Agriculture is part of the United Nations,
yeah.
Right?
Right, all under the auspices, the grand umbrella of the UN. And it kind of trundled along for several decades, not really that important and not really that well attended, until the Uruguay round of treaties in, 94-95, which created the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and that became actually the enforcement arm for Codex. Then all of a sudden it took on importance. So what is Codex really about? It's about creating global food standards, harmonizing food standards. And it actually, Catherine, has two very noble goals. The first is to eliminate trade barriers to food. We could agree with that. The second is to protect the consumer from bad foods. We could agree with that. It's just the implementation of it that's gone wrong, and that's where we really part company with a lot of the Codex attendees and delegates, because keep in mind that they're creating these guidelines and standards at these various meetings. Now, the Codex Alimentarius Commission, which is kind of the parent body, meets every year annually. It just met a few weeks ago. I was there at the Geneva meeting, and it lasts about a week. Each meeting lasts about that long. But it can't do all the work itself, so it's delegated out to various host countries, committees that deal with certain issues, like the one that first attracted the National Health Federation's interest was the Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Special Dietary Uses, which is a real mouthful, but basically is the Nutrition Committee and is the one that's trying to dumb down our vitamin and mineral supplements, and that's why it caught our eye the most. Then there are other committees like the Codex Committee on Food Labeling, the Codex Committee on Food Additives, the Codex Committee on Contaminants in Food, the Codex Committee on Natural Mineral Waters, the Codex Committee on General Principles, the Codex Committee on Food Hygiene. You know, the list goes on, and I could name about another 15 or 18 different committees, but each one is hosted by a particular government. They provide the chairman or the chairwoman, and then the delegates who attend are member country states, and they send their FDA equivalent functionary or bureaucrat to sit in there and help draft these guidelines that will affect all of us. Now, the NHF, I was originally attending the meeting as a member of the U.S. delegation, but it really just lets you observe. You sit like a bump on a log, and you can't speak out at the meeting. In fact, you're actually forbidden to do so, or even to lobby another country or delegation. But there are organizations that are there called INGOs, the International Non-Governmental Organizations. They have the right to speak out at the meeting. They have the right to submit written papers. They have the right to interact in real time with the other delegates there. And when I was kicked off the U.S. delegation for being too contrary, so to speak, and being too suggestive as to the health freedom positions the U.S. delegate should take, well, I was able to get, within a span of about 6 weeks' time, get the U.S., the National Health Federation accredited by the Codex Commission as a recognized INGO, and that gave us the right to start speaking out at the meetings. And I bet the U.S. delegate rues the day that she didn't keep me on the delegation of the U.S. because that would have kept me silent. And so we've been doing that ever since, and we've actually garnered a lot of support over the years from the other delegates because they're hearing a different viewpoint, because quite often we are the only health freedom voice there. We're certainly the only health freedom organization that is accredited and can do this. No one else can do that. And most of the other INGOs, I'd say 98%, are trade organizations. They're like the International Dairy Federation. They're like the World Research Sugar Organization.
They're like basically lobbying for agribusiness.
Exactly. And some actually, like CropLife International, that's Monsanto-driven. The International Federation for Animal Health, that's Eli Lilly and Elanco. They have the president, all of that. They speak out there. They influence the U.S. delegates. They influence a lot of the FDA-type bureaucrats who attend these meetings, who wouldn't know health freedom if it hit them on the head. So we're definitely the fly in the soup in Codex, and we're known for that. We're known as being the bad boys at Codex. But the funny thing about it is that I've noticed over the last 3, maybe 4 years, we've gotten a lot of respect for our positions. I've had FAO people, I've had delegates from the countries come up to me and congratulate me for speaking out on certain issues and actually seeking our support. The Malaysian delegation does that routinely, to speak out on certain issues, like on trans fatty acids, things of that sort. But what really drives it all home is that the reason that Codex is important is to all of us, to all your listeners right now, is because through various treaties that we've signed, the U.S. has signed, like the Technical Barriers to Trade, the WTO, of course, I already mentioned, but the SPS agreement, the Sanitary and Phytosanitary Agreement, these all mention Codex. Codex is the standard, and if a Codex standard is in place, then a country can use it as a club or as a shield, as the case may be, to either go against a country that's not letting in, for example, their GMO crops, or to use it as a shield to prevent the GMO crops going in. That's why this recent thing about GMO food labeling was so important, because the U.S. has been going around the world, especially in the third world, the developing countries, and using the threat of a WTO trade sanction to bully these smaller countries into accepting GMO terminator crops and terminator seeds and GMO foods in general into their country. But with this recent victory that we had in Quebec City at the Food Labeling Committee recently, we provided a document. Even though it's a fairly weak document, it's still strong enough for these third world countries to hold up and say, hey, we aren't afraid of you anymore because we now have a Codex standard that will actually keep us from being threatened, or at least certainly threatened in a realistic way by a WTO lawsuit, trade suit.
So who's pushing GMO through Kodak? Who's trying to get Kodak to adopt GMO or to protect GMO and some of these other policies that we're so concerned about? Is the U.S.
really
the big...
The U.S., yeah, absolutely. The U.S., Canada, Mexico, basically your Western Hemispheric countries are all behind this, almost uniformly, with the exception of Brazil, although Brazil then teams up with the U.S. And Canada and the other countries on the ractopamine and some of the other drugs that are given to animals issue. But the bottom line is you have the companies, the big agribusiness, the big corporations like Monsanto, who realize, you know, these regulatory agencies, it's normal to think they're there to help protect us, but actually long ago they've been captured by the very industries they're meant to regulate, and they drive the engine, really, that tells these bureaucrats what to do. And you see this throughout the world and at the various FDA levels in various countries. But what's the easiest thing to do? Boy, if you have Kodak and you capture it, you get the big banana. So
Right. Consequently,
they're like an increased flame in a in a house, it draws the moths and all those other bad bugs around it with an increasing frequency because it's a bigger flame. Kodak is. And you have more of these type of companies going in and putting a concerted push on Kodak to pass these rules and regulations. But fortunately, some areas, I started to say countries, but areas like blocks, regional blocks like the EU, the Chinese, believe it or not, and some others have been opposing both the GMO and the ractopamine, the veterinary drug that's given to pigs and to cattle before slaughter, and there's no washout period. So you and I, if you're eating bacon in the United States, you're eating ractopamine-doped meat, but not if you eat it in Ireland or in France, for example, so because they've successfully resisted it. And we had a victory on that, by the way, a couple of weeks ago at the Codex meeting in Geneva. But anyway, to answer your question, it's really more about... It's more about preventing these bureaucrats from being captured, which is a never-ending job, because the big corporations that are doing the capturing have a lot of money, a lot of presence, they have a lot of time and energy to go do this. Here we are, the National Health Federation, and we depend upon members and donations, and it's not really the same league. But the one thing that is different is that, and it's noticeably so, is that when we speak out at the meetings, they can tell, the delegates can tell, and they've remarked on it to me personally, that we're speaking from the heart. When you hear someone like the U.S. delegate speak, she is just reading from a script, and you can tell it. It happened at the last meeting. It's almost embarrassing how little conviction there is in what they're pushing.
Have you ever thought of getting the Yes Men to do something on Kodak? Do you know who the Yes Men are?
No, I don't.
Oh, you're kidding!
The Yes Men.
You're in for some fun, Scott. They're two activists, and they put up a website that is it's kind of a spoof on the World Trade Organization, and people started inviting them to speak, and so they show up with people thinking that they're coming from the WTO. And then they do a kind of spoof, and it's outrageous. I mean, they just do amazing stuff. Yeah, it's very, very... They have two DVDs out, and in fact, I think we did one on the Let's Go to the Movies on the Salary Report, but I should do something on the Yes Men, because they're funny as all get out, and they're just outrageous.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, no, you would...
I'm glad you told me.
They got, right after the Bhopal decision in India, they got on... after one decision, they got on somebody from the networks, I think it was CNN called them, and they came and they acted as though they were from Dow and said they were going to reverse it and pay everybody and make good on the whole thing. And the stock dropped some amazing amount, you know, over $1 billion. And it was quite a mess. You know, it was very funny.
Well, thank you for telling me about this. I'll have to look into it more. Yes.
Well, what, you know, we always, I don't know, you know, I'm one of those people who always gets these emails saying, oh, they're going to do this at Codex and it's going to be the end of the world and you'll starve to death because you won't be able to get any nutrition. How bad is it? How bad is the effort to sort of make everybody take GMO?
Well, it's probably worse than we hope, but not as bad as we fear. I would say that a lot of these, the more prominent organizations out there that are proclaiming themselves as experts on Codex actually send out a lot of misinformation, and we've noticed it ourselves. There was one organization, the Natural Solutions Foundation, that back in March of 2005, they had on their website that Codex was going to remove all vitamin mineral food supplements from American health food store shelves by July 31, 2005. And I talked to the leader of that outfit, Rima LeBeau, and I told her directly, I said, look, this isn't going to happen, and when it doesn't happen, you're going to look bad, and not only that, you're going to taint all the rest of us who are anti-Codex as being in the same camp as you. So please remove it. And she said no. She left it up. Well, of course, here we are almost, 6 years later, and there are more supplements on the shelves in the U.S. than there were in 2005, not fewer, but more. And then the same thing happened again with her and her organization in December of 2009, and she had put up, oh, Codex is going to come into effect December 31st, 2009. And, of course, that wasn't true either. She had been confusing the European Union's Food Supplements Directive with the Codex process. And a lot of people do that. They mix them up, and they've done it even more recently, not Natural Solutions Foundation, but another outfit, with the Traditional Herbal Products, Medicinal Products Directive of the EU, which just took effect, and some people were attributing that to Codex, and it had nothing to do with Codex. So you do have to be extremely careful about what information you get off the Internet. And if I may be so self-serving, I would say go to the NHF.com website, the NHF.com website, click on the Codex button, and there you can be assured of getting the accurate information, because we're the ones on the spot there. We're the ones attending the meetings, or at least many of the meetings. We can't afford to go to all of them, but we go to as many as we can, certainly the important ones, and we report on it. And,
right, and the other thing, this is so complex. It's you know, if you want to rule the world, you have to engineer into complex systems.
That's right.
And
Catherine, you know what? Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it's terribly expensive to keep up on complex systems, let alone to understand them, let alone to take the time to go do something about them. And, of course, most people are busy doing whatever it is they do. And and as you watch all this invasive effort to centralize in system after system after system, whether it's food or transportation or finance or whatever, you know, how is somebody supposed to keep up on all of this? So, it can be overwhelming. And I think food standards is very, very complicated. So.
It is, and even now, 11, going on 12 years later, I still have much to learn about many of the areas at Codex and the like. But the funny thing is, I'm just amazed that we made it this far and have had the impact that we have had at these meetings, and it's been an amazing journey. But in this case, we have made some really good impacts with the vitamin mineral nutrient reference values. They're sort of like the RDIs, and we have that battle coming up in November in Germany with the Nutrition Committee meeting that I mentioned before I mentioned the Nutrition Committee. And that will come up, and NHF by itself 2 years ago turned that whole thing around. They wanted to dumb down the RDIs, for example. They wanted to reduce the recommended daily intake for dietary intake for vitamin C from 60 milligrams down to 45 milligrams. And that was going to sail through the process. There's like an 8-step process at Codex from initial conception to final adoption. And it was going to sail through, except that I spoke out at the meeting and spent almost an hour debating the rest of the crowd there and was able to get it delayed long enough so that the next year's meeting, that is last year's meeting in November in Chile, I had allies at that point. By that point, I barely had to argue. And we'll have the same debate coming up in this year's meeting in November, and I expect to have even more allies at that point. So I think we can turn it around. But the interesting thing about it is the Australian delegate who is most behind pushing this, I asked her, how did you come up with 45 milligrams, for example, on vitamin C? She said, well, it's halfway between scurvy, which essentially is complete death, tissue saturation at the higher end for vitamin C. So I just took the halfway point. So I said, do you really mean that? You took the halfway point between death and full health as the what the standard should be here? She said, yes. So that's their kind of thinking. It's this very bureaucratic mindset that is almost obscenely ridiculous at times.
You're being kind.
And
I think it's psychopathic.
Yeah, psychopathic.
They're told to go in a certain direction, and they head in that direction, but do it in a way that's quite, yeah.
So
well,
I just made fun of it. So
let's step out of the international for a second, because there are things going on domestically with FDA in this area that I think we, you know, would be great to address now, because the latest series of scare emails relate to what the FDA is up to, and especially there's a lot of concern here because of the recent decisions on genetically modified food by the USDA and FDA.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Are you talking in terms of the Durbin bill, or are you talking about...
If you could just give us an update on what's happening here. Because we, as Americans, have to worry about two standards. Well, everybody has to worry about two standards. One is the what happens internationally and whether or not that can be enforced against in your place. But then it's also possible that something in your country is...
absolutely.
And, you know, because the U.S. is such a big influencer, if the U.S. is able to do something particularly ugly here, you know, and come in at bottom up, then we can expect to see it upstairs, you know, momentarily.
Well, if you're talking about the GMO foods, I mean, they, as everyone knows, you know, some 88% of the corn sold in the U.S. is GMO crop, similarly for soybeans and the like. So it's freely sold within the U.S., not so freely sold over here in France or in the European Union, for example. That's why, because even though they got a WTO trade sanction against them, the European Union pays quite a big chunk of change every year to keep in penalties to keep these GMO crops out. But in terms of the real push...
I would point out it's in the feed. Because they're taking it in the animal feed?
Absolutely. They feed them a lot of corn, a lot of soybeans, and the like. So they're taking it up into their system, absorbing it, and then we're eating it that way as well. Even if one tries to avoid it, it's very tough to avoid it in the U.S. And the GMO crops or GMO food produce is very questionable about its health value because of a large number of studies that show health problems that are derived from it. But the real push in the U.S. is to try to limit the vitamin and mineral and dietary supplement intake of the U.S., U.S. citizens and residents, because this is the counterweight to all the bad things they're giving us, the excessive vaccinations, the fluoridation in the water, lowered nutritional content of the foods over the last 50 years. You know, it's been knocked down by about 50%. And then you have all the people on drugs. You have the ractopamine I mentioned in foods is just an example of the drugs in the foods. You have all sorts of melamine and other contaminants that we're ingesting. And how do we defend ourselves health-wise against that? Well, most people will supplement their diet with dietary supplements. By doing that, you can protect yourself. So that's why there's a big drive to eliminate those as much as possible. The other reason, of course, is it's in competition with the drug companies. And the drug companies spend $6 million a day lobbying Congress and the FDA to get things done their way. So right now you have Dick Durbin, who introduced his Dietary Supplement Labeling Act of 2011. You have the FDA just released its FDA guidance for industry on new dietary ingredients, all meant to clamp down on the freedoms that we got back in 1994 through the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act that was passed in that year that removed the arbitrary powers of the FDA to take supplements off the market just because they deemed them as food additives or adulterated. And in fact, the big kind of secret behind dietary supplements is their incredible safety. Everyone talks about them as if, oh, the consumers need to be protected from supplements and these new dietary ingredients and the like. But where are the dead bodies? They're nowhere to be found.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody has gotten sick.
Yeah, you can, and actually, most of the ones that are attributed to supplements, like this Blecko guy who supposedly died from ephedra, he probably more likely died from aspartame and his seesaw dietary practices and eating habits that he had and the excessive heat at that time than from the ephedra that he also took or supposedly took. But nevertheless, these are all touted as dangerous substances that need to be controlled. But when you look at the statistics, a person is more likely to die from a bee sting, from falling off a horse, or from being hit by a lightning bolt than he is from taking a supplement. In fact, the only thing more dangerous statistically that's been tracked is being hit, that it's more dangerous than, is a meteor hitting you on the head. You're more likely to die from taking a supplement than by being struck by a meteorite while you're walking down the street. So I guess it is indeed dangerous. But if you look at the top of the chart, you'll see hundreds of thousands of deaths every year from government-approved drugs, government-licensed hospitals, government-licensed doctors, medical doctors. And we aren't talking a few. We're talking over right. 800,000 deaths a year, yeah. Year in, year out. And yet they want to turn their attention, their little microscopic focus, laser beam focus, on these so deadly dietary supplements that, you know, they can't produce any bodies for. So this is the ludicrous situation that we're facing, and these people need to be laughed out of the halls of Congress, and the FDA needs to be told to go be sent packing, because what they're trying to do is just reduce our ability to protect ourselves, and we need to stop that, and we can't let that happen. So I propose for the NHF that we launch a DSHEA 2, which essentially, maybe it's too long and complex to go into here, but essentially will extend our liberties that we started with DSHEA in 1994 and protect us from sort of these new attempts by bureaucrats and politicians to rein in our ability to take the vitamins, minerals we want to. Because right now, if the FDA guidance goes through, a lot of the new dietary ingredients that have come onto the market since 1994, like resveratrol, curcumin, GABA, that's an amino acid, GABA, bioperine, and some others, will have to go through approval processes before they can be put on the market. And with 1,000 new products coming onto the market each and every year, we're going to see a real crimp in innovation. But, of course, bureaucrats don't mind that. They relish the thought of...
One of the things I wanted to tie this to is if you look at, you know, I was describing during Money and Markets the fact that many people do not understand the extent to which our local economies and household economies are dependent on federal programs, contracts, monies of various kinds. The other thing I think it's not, we don't begin to understand is the extent to which our national income has fallen because of food rules and how many small farmers and small businesses it's put out of business. I mean, this is really what we're describing is a process which is allowing the whole food chain to be controlled by large corporations. And what that is doing is it's not just lowering the quality of the food system, it's dramatically reducing the amount of income that comes within a local area, literally globally, from small farming, small grocers, and all different kinds of food businesses and processors. And the most powerful weapon of economic warfare behind the centralization of agriculture is food safety and these food standards. And it's not just cutting in our ability to get good food. It's seriously cutting into our income and equity valuations as households.
Absolutely. And I agree with that. I think it's a multi-pronged approach, or at least multi-reasoned approach as to how they're doing it, why they're doing it. And it's relentless. They just keep on. If they don't get it one year, then they keep on the next year until they make progress. And a lot of it is based on the mantra, the false mantra, that we're protecting the consumer. How could anyone complain about extra rules being heaped on? But what they don't tell the public, and what the public often forgets with its goldfish-like memory, is that these rules and regulations have a cost. They aren't free. And you see that in just the distinction. In the U.S., you can go and buy natural vitamin D, 5,000 units a day, and it would cost you, in the equivalent in European Union money, euro, it would cost you about 2 euros a month to have this kind of protection that will help protect your immune system, help make you resistant to viruses and cancer, dramatically so, by the way. And yet, when I was in Finland giving a speech about a year and a half ago, I had the organizer take me into a health food shop there, and we tried to piece together, because you couldn't buy 5,000 international unit capsules of vitamin D, so we had to piece together 500 IU equivalents and multiply that out. It would have cost 60 euros. 60
euros. Oh, my
euros.
Word.
And I guarantee you the quality of that was no better than the American one, probably worse. But when you think about the socialized welfare system that they have over there, the medical system, where they subsidize drugs, you get the average person, they go into a pharmacy, they're going to get their subsidized drug for 1 euro, and then on one hand, they look at that, then on the other hand, they look at the 60-euro vitamin D. What do you think most people are going to do? This is one of the hidden dangers of the socialized welfare system, certainly the socialized medical system in Europe, and that's coming to the U.S., or actually is already here, but in any event, is that it steers people towards the medical monopoly mafia that already exists to keep doing more of the same failed techniques and processes that have already killed, like I was saying, 800,000 people a year. Not the way to keep you healthy, but the way to keep you unhealthy. And
Scott,
I think that's deliberate as well.
We're almost out of time, and there are two questions I want to ask you, but I've got to be quick about it. One came in from a subscriber who appears to be a dear friend of yours. It says, Catherine, please ask Scott when he will allow his cat, Buzz, to drive the car. Buzz asked me to submit this, and you don't have to answer the question.
I know who that was. Thanks, Paul.
But now we know the name of your cat. And but the other thing is you know, I'm always the Soleri Circle, the Soleri Report subscribers know that, you know, I'm very suspicious that this move to centralized control of seed and food supply is very much related to building the case for a controlled global currency. But you said something to me very interesting about centralization through the food system and how it relates to the other areas of life. And I wish you would just tell us before we finish up. Remember what that was?
I remember my general principle, which is, but I don't know if we have time for it, but the general concept is that danger lies in centralization. It always has. The more remote the rulers are from the people, the more apt they are to be corrupt, to take action that is widely destructive. In fact, the U.S. gained its strength originally because it was founded as a decentralized constitutional republic. In fact, most Americans in the first 100 years or so of its existence were known by the states they came from. You know, they were New Yorkers, they were Floridians, they were Vermonters, they were not Americans. In fact, the typical American had virtually zero contact with the federal government up until the time of the American Civil War, unless they went down to the post office to mail a letter and they came into contact with the U.S. postmaster. But that was the strength of our country, because you could look at the legislator in the eye one-on-one and tell him what you thought of him. But we've turned that all on its head, and we're getting to the centralization, especially in regional blocks and the flattening forces of globalization and the like. And it's just getting away from that principle, and it's leading to our decline. I mean, a huge decline. I don't know if that's what you were asking.
One of the things you said was that you thought what they were doing with food was sort of a prototype for what they were going to do
thank you. Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Catherine. Thanks. It's really true, and this was actually said by my friend Ian Crane, who was new to Codex, and he said, very interesting observation. He said, Codex is really nothing more than a template. And I thought about it, and I thought, yes, they're kind of road testing this globalization process through Codex, because it was already in place. It's an easy way to do it. People will buy into it because of wanting to protect food and the consumers and have food trade be worldwide. So it's really a template for these other things, like the ones you're talking about, Catherine, with the international kind of harmonization, if I can call it that, of the money supply. And they're road testing it all through Codex, first of all.
There's a wonderful book by Michael Woodyworth, who's a professor in England. It's published by a Canadian company called Organized Crime and American Power, or American Power and Organized Crime. And he traces the creation of the laws related to the war on drugs in the United States, and how then, after they're sort of prototyped and developed, it's taken up through the UN and turned into a global, you know, kind of goes global. And there was a legislator from New Zealand who also did the same thing with accounting rules. And you kind of see this sort of very sneaky centralization through these global rules and other areas. So I agree. I think what's happening on Codex is very, very important to food and very, very important to currency, but very, very important to centralization, you know, and how centralization is being engineered across the board. Well, give us 1 minute and tell us how we can keep up with you and your efforts.
NHF, yes. If they go to, thanks for asking, if they'll go to the website, which is nhf.com, and they can go there, sign up on our e-list. It's free, and we're fanatics about protecting your privacy and not spamming you. We don't trade it with anyone else. And through that, get educated. And more than that, if you would join NHF, it's the princely sum of $36, which will break no one's pocketbook or back, that would be even better. But at least, at the very least, sign up on the e-list. And then read through on the articles on Codex. There's a nice Codex overview. We also have a Codex book that I compiled and is available for purchase.
And I should say, I've been a member for several years, and your magazine is very good.
Well, thank you, and thanks to you. I think it'll improve even more, because we got a great art director now and a great graphic artist to redesign it, and it's going to be even more improved. And, you know, as sort of a special thing to your subscribers, if anyone wants to contact me personally, my email address is my first name, Scott, at Monaco, M-O-N-A-C-O, .mc, Mother Charlie. Just when you email me, put something about Catherine Austin Fitz in the subject line so I don't think it's spam and delete it immediately. And I'll be happy to carry on, you know, whatever conversation I can on this. But in any event, the main thing is get educated, join with us, and then take action, because our motto is, basically politicians don't see the light, they feel the heat. And
right.
we have a whole technique for putting the persistent pressure on these people, on these men and women in Congress, to get them to open up and more to freedom in general and health freedom in particular. So this is very, very important, but it's super important to be educated on the right issues so you don't go down a false path, a false garden path, but instead take effective action and do it in a very persistent, directed, and focused manner. And then that way we can make changes, and indeed we have made changes, and we'll keep doing it. I think we'll see light at the end of the tunnel. We'll go through a dark period, and I've been following your things as well, Catherine, and what you've been saying, and I think they're all very true, and we just need to prepare ourselves for the future, and if we do it, we'll come out ahead. But if we blind
yeah.
and we follow the false prophets, we won't. I mean, that's really the bottom line.
I'm a great believer that until the miracles happen, trench warfare really counts for a lot.
It does.
So
that's
I send
point.
You off with a great prayer for your efforts.
You.
You know, what you do is very hard work, and you're very good at it. So, and we appreciate
well.
It. So I am a member of NHF, and I recommend it to everybody on the call. So, Scott, thank you very much. And
thank you.
Enjoy
and
Paris.
For
we're jealous.
Well, I appreciate it. I'll be leaving it shortly, so I'm only here for, you know, another week. But thank you for saying
okay.
that, and thank you for all that you do. That's so important. You're part of the getting educated part that everyone needs. So you're an important link in this whole chain, and you are much appreciated, too.
Well, thank you for that. Have
thank
a good
you.
Evening. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm leaving California and headed back to Tennessee. On August 4th, we're going to have wonderful Sally Fallon on Nourishing Tradition. She's the head of the Weston Price Foundation, just a marvelous resource. And then August 11th, Precious Metals with Franklin. I'll be back with Franklin in person in Tennessee. And then the following, a wonderful young documentary maker, Jamie Johnson, who's done two incredible documentaries interviewing the rich about what in the world they think about, you know, the centralization of wealth and what all is going on. Very charming, very interesting. And so until August 4th with Sally Fallon, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.